Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Italy targets 18 suspects. Italian police say they are conducting raids targeting 18 suspected Islamic extremists who are believed to be connected to attacks in Pakistan and may have planned an assault on the Vatican. An Italian prosecutor told reporters in Sardinia Friday that two people thought to have been bodyguards for Osama bin Laden are among the suspects. He said intercepted phone calls indicated signals of some preparation for a possible attack on the Vatican, which was never carried out. Police said the subjects of the operation were all believed to be Pakistanis or Afghans, and that the nationwide sweep is ongoing. The United Nations says civilian casualties have mounted since the start of the Saudi-led bombing campaign against Shiite Houthi rebels in Yemen. The UN said on Friday the civilian death toll since the bombing started late last month is estimated at 551. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, says at least 115 were children. After a brief calm in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, the airstrikes continued on Friday, 3 days after Saudi Arabia declared an end to the bombing campaign. Thousands of people and several world leaders gathered in Armenia Friday to mark the 100th anniversary of the World War I killing of Armenians by Ottoman Turks. Guests visited a memorial, a hilltop monument leaning inwards towards a flame set up in a sunken bowl. Speaking at the site in the capital, Yerevan, Armenian President Serzha Sarkisyan thanked world leaders for their presence and their commitment to human values by saying nothing here has been forgotten. This is VOA News. The United Nations Refugee Agency has praised plans by the European Union to triple its funding for maritime search and rescue operations in the Mediterranean, but said the key issue to refugee safety is access to asylum when fleeing violence in their own country. The UN High Commission for Refugees said Friday that broadening search and rescue operations is an important first step, but added that refugees must have some other avenue to get to safety if the problem of refugee deaths at sea is to be solved. As Europe focused on the problem of migrants at sea, 14 migrants traveling by land through central Macedonia late Thursday were hit and killed by a train as they took a commonly used land route through the Balkans. Hundreds of protesters gathered in downtown Baltimore, Maryland, Thursday to, again, demand changes to the justice system following the death of a 25-year-old man taken into custody last week. VOA's Victoria Mackey has more from the rally.
Don't shoot! Hands up! Don't shoot!
With hands and voices raised, demonstrators marched for hours around Baltimore. Starting between City Hall and police headquarters, the crowd stopped traffic to demand accountability from local officials for what they allege was an act of police brutality. Among the protesters, Jamal Bryant, who helped organize the event. He wants improvements for the majority black city's residents and changes across the country.
This was the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back. This isn't a new incident. We're seeing the same thing from Sanford, Florida to Ferguson, Missouri, now right here in Baltimore, that there's got to be an overhaul of the complete system.
Victoria Mackey, VOA News, Baltimore.
French President Francois Hollande has urged his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, to move forward with implementing a European-brokered ceasefire agreement to resolve the conflict in eastern Ukraine. The two leaders met on the sidelines of ceremonies in Yerevan Friday, commemorating the 100th anniversary of the massacre of Armenians in the Ottoman Empire during World War I. Fighting between government forces and pro-Russian separatists in the Donbas region has killed more than 6,000 people and displaced a million others. For his part, President Putin called on Mr. Hollande to restore ties between their countries after a year of tensions over Ukraine. A series of new studies by U.S. seismological experts is drawing a closer link between drilling for oil and gas and the disturbing rise in the number of earthquakes in areas not usually prone to seismic activity. The problem is taking on a new urgency as the U.S. has rapidly expanded oil and gas production in recent years through the use of a controversial drilling technique known as hydraulic fracturing or fracking. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Some of the essence of the proposals being put forward are really all about sealing off the last porous entry point to Europe, which is the most dangerous sea route, so that Fortress Europe is then finally completed.
That's John Dalhissen of Amnesty International commenting on the European Union's new plans for curbing thousands of migrants crossing the Mediterranean Sea. Details coming up also in the news. The Sierra Leone Ministry of Health enhances its campaign to vaccinate children against polio, measles and other serious health risks. We'll have these stories. Plus, the sunny side of sports with Douglas and Puga. Sitting in for Sunny, music from Uganda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, a European plan aimed at stemming the deaths of migrants crossing the Mediterranean Sea is getting a mixed response from United Nations and international agencies. They welcome the expanded effort, but say it fails to address the root causes pushing people to flee. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Both the UN Refugee Agency and the International Organization for Migration are welcoming the European Union's decision to expand its search and rescue mission in the Mediterranean Sea. They call the tripling of funding for joint naval operations an important first step towards stopping the loss of migrants' lives. So far this year, more than 1,700 people have drowned attempting to cross from Libya to Europe. Nearly 40,000 refugees and migrants in all have made the perilous journey in rickety smugglers' boats. Ministers attending the emergency EU summit on migrants Thursday said their operation would have similar capacity and scope to Italy's Mare Nostrum operation. That rescue operation saved tens of thousands of lives before it was shut down at the end of October and replaced by Triton, a much smaller European operation. UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says collective action is the only approach that can stop the intensifying tragedy playing out on Europe's southern frontiers. He adds it is crucial that humanitarian and human rights principles are at the center of Europe's approach.
The boat crossings are not just a migrant phenomenon, they are a refugee one too. Half those who crossed the Mediterranean in 2014 were people seeking refuge from wars and persecution. And for refugees fleeing war, there has to be some alternative to having to cross the Mediterranean in smugglers' boats. Efforts still need to be made to address the root causes pushing people to flee and to support governments in truly protecting refugees and others more effectively, ensuring full respect for their human rights.
The UNHCR says the EU summit failed to comprehensively address issues such as the resettlement and relocation of refugees and the creation of channels for safe and regular migration. It notes European governments also have not committed themselves to sharing the burden of resettling survivors. Currently, most of the migrants are being received and assisted by Italy, Greece, and Malta. The EU plan emphasizes the need to secure borders and to end the smugglers' trade in migrants by destroying their boats. The spokesman for the International Organization for Migration, Leonard Doyle, says he does not believe that approach will work.
Destroying ships is, of course, important if these are smugglers, but at the end of the day, what does it take to destroy a rubber dinghy? And how quickly can a rubber dinghy be replaced? So it's an important aspect of the problem, but it's one of many, many aspects, and it's hardly going to deter the smugglers if ships, which they destroy anyway after most rescues, are being destroyed.
UN and international agencies also are calling on European governments to combat racist and xenophobic rhetoric. On Friday, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayed Raad al-Hussein, condemned a recent article in a British tabloid, The Sun, which characterized migrants as cockroaches. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Among those reacting to the migrant rescue plan is Yves Pesquet, the Director of Migration and Mobility Policies at the European Policy Center in Brussels, Belgium. He told the reporter William Eagle that the EU plan seems to place more emphasis on search and rescue than on military patrols aimed at preventing migration.
That's true. From the advance copy that was available online, we can see that there are at least three chapter which will be addressed. One which is related to surveillance and rescue at sea, or the presence of Frontex operation at sea, which will not be at the level expected, i.e. even if they double the finances and the assets made available for the Frontex operation, the Triton operation in particular, this is not going to be enough to save people at sea. The second point, and you're right, is mainly related to the fight against traffickers and the fight against illegal migration. And here we have clearly a set of measures which are clearly directed towards the idea of making it a priority to fight against these two phenomena. The fight against against traffickers is going to be addressed through perhaps some military actions, which still to be decided and clearly defined. And the fight against illegal migration is mainly included into the chapter, which is related to the cooperation with third countries. In to sum up, and if we could sum up this at this point in time, there is a continuous concern by EU member states in order to have a security-oriented approach rather than something which would clearly help people to avoid dying at sea.
What are some of the fissures? What is some of the background to that difference? Why do some countries favor more search and rescue versus those who support a stronger border patrol policy?
With respect to search and rescue operations, we have heard some member states, and including the UK, for instance, which say that search and rescue operation act as a pull factor for irregular migration, which has to be proven, and for the timing, this has not been proven. So we have, for instance, Italy, which has developed a large-scale rescue operation over 2013 and 2014, the so-called Mare Nostrum operation, and we know that Italy is calling for more support in this regard. But it is clear that the United Kingdom, but also some of the member states, are feeling more reluctant to provide with this solution, because they really think, and despite the fact that there is no proof about that, they really think that this is a pull factor of irregular migration.
Some European solutions have centered on paying, for example, North African states and Egypt to better patrol their own waters to keep migrants from leaving. Others want processing centers, EU's processing centers, set up in African states. Can you comment on some of these ideas? What are other possible cooperative agreements that could be reached between the EU and North African or sub-Saharan countries?
Well, there are two types of agreements which could be achieved. One would be to offer support from the EU to third countries and some of the African, Northern African countries, to offer financial support in order to help these countries to better patrol or control their borders, be it land or sea borders. So this is one element. And this is something which is going perhaps and most certainly to come out from the meeting today, to develop cooperation with those countries in the field of border management and migration management. The other point is related to, let's say, processing centers. And this is a much more difficult issue to deal with, because millions of people are seeking for protection in the region. So we have to consider the size and the magnitude of the phenomenon, and we have to consider all solutions possible in order to grant protection to people in need of protection. So one solution could be to develop processing centers outside of the EU. But from my own point of view, this could be possible only if two conditions are fulfilled. First, with which member states or with which state do we deal with, do we cooperate with? And this has to do with the reliability of the states we are dealing with. And the question today is the following. Is Libya, for instance, a state with which we can negotiate? And from my point of view, there is no serious counterpart in Libya to deal with. So addressing the right partner is one key issue. Second point, if we decide to set up processing centers, which could be run, by instance, by the UNHCR or any international organization, running and managing this kind of processing center should only be done on the basis of one key element, the full respect of human rights. If we are not able to clearly make sure that within these processing centers, human rights will be respected, then we are not able to set up those processing centers.
That was Yves Pasquier, Director of Migration and Mobility Policies at the European Policy Center in Brussels, Belgium. He spoke with reporter William Eagle. The rights group Amnesty International is very critical of the EU plan to deal with the Mediterranean migration crisis. John Dalhissen is Amnesty's director for Europe and Central Asia. From London, he told VOA's Jody Capua that the plan to beef up the current Triton naval operation is more face-saving than life-saving.
The core issue here is that it's a response that really only meets the tragedy, the crisis, halfway. And I mean that very literally. Whilst they're deploying more assets, more boats, at least we've seen commitments for this, and they still need to be followed up on in practice, the area in which these boats will be deployed remains limited to the current operational area of the Triton operation. And that's still several nautical miles short, at least 75, of the areas that the previous Italian operation was operating in, and therefore still far too far away from the Libyan coast where refugees, migrants, and boats come into peril. They need to be operating much closer to where the distress first starts.
And what kind of an impact would that have, being 70-something miles closer to the Libyan shore?
Well, it's several hours of traveling time eliminated, and speed is very much of the essence in rescue operations. So from distress call to arrival, if you're reducing that travel time to an hour and a half from 4 or 5, well, that can definitely be the difference between life and death.
It seems like it would be a rather simple thing to do to expand the area. Why isn't it being done?
You would have thought. Some of it is certainly relates to technicalities of the EU border agency Frontex that runs Triton and the limitations on its mandate and the concern that if you were to operate beyond Italy's territorial waters with a search and rescue mandate, that wouldn't be within the competences as currently defined of Frontex. I think there are technical solutions to that problem even within the current mandate, but the bottom line is they didn't need to use Triton as the vehicle for this search and rescue operation. It would have been equally effective, indeed could have been deployed tomorrow, for individual countries simply to have deployed naval assets in the areas where they are required. So whilst it's a combination of technicalities, there is something at the very least curious about only going halfway when the consequences of only going halfway must have been obvious to everyone in the room.
Would you consider the EU's Triton operation truly a search and rescue program?
It's not a search and rescue program at all. It's quite explicitly not, as its director never ceases to say. I mean, I wonder what he would describe it as now, but probably still not a search and rescue operation. That's certainly not explicitly in its mandate. Now, it is true that under the laws of the sea, regardless, any naval vessel, any boat in proximity of a distress signal can be commandeered by a search and rescue center to go to the rescue. And this would apply to Triton assets as well. But this is then an ancillary task rather than their primary task.
Why didn't the EU reconsider the Mare Nostrum effort that Italy had put forth?
Italy wasn't necessarily offering to take the burden on itself entirely. And I don't think that was ever necessarily a realistic ask. But bare minimum ask was at least replicate, if not extend, what Mare Nostrum had. And that would not ultimately have been a very complicated thing to do. And it's certainly, the bottom line, hugely disappointing and rather surprising, given the awakening over the last week, that European leaders didn't go the whole way.
What about the EU's efforts to provide asylum to those, some of those at least, coming over?
It should be providing asylum to all those who have protection needs. That's not a generous offer. That's an obligation and a basic human requirement. There's certainly nothing new in that kind of talk. The main thing is that Europe continues to offer safe and legal routes for those fleeing conflict and persecution to arrive in Europe. And some of the subtext of the discussion around the Mediterranean crisis and some of the essence of the proposals being put forward are really all about sealing off the last porous entry point to Europe, which is the most dangerous sea route, so that Fortress Europe is then finally completed. And then you'll have a situation where the European Union, one of the richest areas in the world, is one of the most impermeable, least accessed by refugees. And that would, I think, be a shameful situation.
John Dalhousie is Amnesty's director for Europe and Central Asia. From London, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kapoor. You were listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Twenty-two past the hour, here's a recap of our top story. A European plan aimed at stemming the deaths of migrants crossing the Mediterranean Sea is getting a mixed response from United Nations and international agencies. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. A spokesman for Nigeria's military says troops are advancing on the last known stronghold of Boko Haram. Chadian troops are also ready to close in on the insurgents. Their target is the Sambisa Forest. It is a vast, heavily wooded area in northeastern Nigeria where the militant forces have established camps. They're also believed to have held more than 200 schoolgirls captive there. A former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria is skeptical of the abilities of a regional military force to end the insurgency with a victory in the forest. John Campbell is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He spoke with VOA's David Arnold.
What information we have basically comes from official Nigerian sources, which in the past have not been particularly reliable. A reason for the shortage of information is that the media is very largely excluded from the area, and there is virtually no diplomatic presence at all. What we basically are dependent on is what the Nigerian government is saying. In effect, it is saying that it has cleared Boko Haram out of virtually all of the territory that it previously occupied, and they're now confined to a kind of rump in the Zambezi Forest, and the Nigerian military are saying that they are prepared to clear them out of that. Boko Haram is a movement. In the past, at least, when it has faced serious opposition, it has essentially melted away into the countryside and into urban slums. And from there, it has regrouped and launched attacks. Even if Boko Haram is cleared out of the Zambezi Forest, it is not necessarily destroyed.
Would you suggest then that they might be generally confined to the Zambezi forest now.
But I would suspect that much of Boko Haram has already gone underground. There are cells of it scattered all over northeastern Nigeria. Senior members of the Nigerian military at one time or another have complained about the shortage of hard intelligence.
Does the Nigerian military know, have good intelligence about Boko Haram?
Almost certainly not. Take something like the famous Chibok schoolgirls. You're talking more than 200 girls who essentially have disappeared. In other words, the Nigerian military doesn't know where they are. The recently elected president of Nigeria, Muhammadu Buhari, who will be sworn into office on May 29th, in fact, acknowledged that last week. He said that his government would do what it could to find the Chibok schoolgirls, but that they didn't know where they were.
You think the threat will continue at the same level that it has for the last two or three years?
It will depend on what the new government does. The new government has talked about a thoroughgoing rebuilding of the Nigerian security services. The new government has also talked about the necessity for replacing essentially a counterterrorism approach to Boko Haram with a counterinsurgency approach. In other words, what the new government is at least considering are various strategies that essentially would deprive Boko Haram of the oxygen of public discontent with conditions in the north. It involves issues like reform of education, improvement of medical services, bringing the security services under control so that they're not committing human rights abuses, and maybe even over time some economic development.
That's former ambassador to Nigeria, John Campbell, who is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He spoke with David Arnold. The Sierra Leone Ministry of Health is taking extra measures to vaccinate the nation's children against polio, measles, and other serious health risks. This as the Ebola epidemic winds down in the countryside. Minister of Health and Sanitation Dr. Abubakar Fofana says fewer mothers and children are visiting health clinics because of the Ebola scare that took the lives of about 3,500 people and devastated the public health delivery system. Fofana made a public appeal to parents and caregivers to reduce the nation's infant mortality. The campaign hopes to reach more than 1.5 million children under the age of five in a country with one of the highest rates of infant mortality in the world. More than 10,000 vaccinators and distributors are going door to door over the next few days. UNICEF country representative Roland Monash says unique safety protocols have been developed for the Sierra Leone campaign. UNICEF is supplying more than a million pairs of gloves, 3,600 hand sanitizers, and 50,000 disposable aprons for use in the campaign. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
The sounds of Africa, today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. A European plan aimed at stemming the deaths of migrants crossing the Mediterranean Sea is getting a mixed response from United Nations and international agencies. And the number of refugees fleeing the Boko Haram insurgency from Nigeria to Cameroon has stabilized in the past month. Coming up, music from Uganda. And in our feature segment, the World Health Organization says the use of cesarean delivery is growing worldwide. I'm Yehiz Wuhib and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Yehiz.
So what do you have for us this evening?
Well, Yehiz, we kick off with African football. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ivory Coast is constructing a 60,000-seat stadium in time for the country's hosting of the 2021 Africa Cup of Nations. The new venue will be located in Abidjan, with work beginning in January next year and taking 2 years to complete. An Ivorian sports minister spokesman said it was a gift from China and construction will be financed by the Chinese government. He added the Olympic Stadium of Ebimpe with 60,000 seats will allow the hosting of high-level football, athletics and rugby tournaments. The project will also include the construction of a sports city around the stadium in the suburb of Anyama. Abidjan currently has just one ground of international standard in the 35,000 capacity Humphrey Boyne Stadium built before independence in 1916.
VOA! I encourage our VOA listeners with internet access to check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. The address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. You'll see photos and videos, and you can post your comments. So check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page.
Voice of America!
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
In Somalia, the Somali Football Association has repeated its call for the African peacekeeping troops to leave the Somali National Stadium in Mogadishu. The 70,000-capacity stadium has been occupied by the African Union mission in Somalia for nearly a decade, preventing it from hosting any sports. The Somali FA president, Abdulkani Saidi Arab, told the BBC that the troops should vacate the stadium in order for it to be used for the purpose it was built for. Saidi Arab said Somalia had been forced to abandon their efforts for this year's Africa Cup of Nations because of their inability to play in their home ground. Despite being known as one of Africa's more modern and well-designed stadiums, capable of hosting basketball, volleyball, and even swimming in addition to football, the Somali National Stadium has barely been used because of over two decades of anarchy and civil war in Somalia. The stadium's occupiers have changed several times. In the early 1990s, American units were based there. It became a base for Ethiopian troops after they invaded Somalia between 2007 and 2009, and lastly, it became a base for the African Union mission. The Somali FA has recently started efforts to exploit the relative peace in the capital with the aim of finally seeing the return of international home matches. Now, for more sports news, let's go to Johannesburg, South Africa, and join Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma for this report.
We begin with athletics. Kenya's Emily Chebet clocked 9 minutes and 10.57 seconds to set a girls' 3,000-meter championship record at the Africa Youth Athletics Championships in Redouit, Mauritius on Thursday. Fellow Kenyan Sheila Chelagat was runner-up ahead of Uganda's Janet Chemusto. On the infield, South Africa's Yolandi Stander claimed victory in the girls' shot put with a heave of 14.95 meters. Algeria's May Masika Miziod won the girls' pole vault with a clearance of 3.20 meters, while South African Werner Fisser won the boys' discus with a throw of 64.88 meters. Staying in Redouit, South Africa took an early lead on the medal table on the first day at the Africa Youth Championship with 2 gold and 1 silver medal. Kenya is second, followed by Algeria, then Egypt. Morocco and Uganda are tied in fifth place with 1 bronze medal each. Turning to volleyball, Ethiopia beat Uganda 18-25, 25-19, 25-17, and 25-13 at the Women's Zone 5 All-Africa Games volleyball qualifiers in Kampala, Uganda on Thursday. Egypt dismissed Burundi in 3 straight sets. In tennis, Kenyan Lawrence Karanja was voted the International Tennis Federation Wheelchair Coach of the Year for 2014. The Kenya Lawn Tennis Association revealed in Nairobi, Kenya on Thursday. The annual award goes to a coach who has contributed towards the national and international development of wheelchair tennis and players. In football, Botswana hosts Kenya in men's All-Africa Games football qualifiers in Lobatse today, Friday. Tomorrow, Saturday, Rwanda welcomes Somalia in Kigali, while Ghana engage visitors Liberia in Accra. Sierra Leone and Mauritania are through to the next round after their opponents Guinea-Bissau and Libya withdrew from the contest. Finally, in boxing, Ghana's Emmanuel Tagoa fights Gilbert De Los Reyes of the Philippines for the WBA International Lightweight Boxing title in Accra, Ghana today, Friday. And
that was Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma in Johannesburg. Thanks, Mark.
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
And now on to athletics. The world fastest man and six-time Olympic gold medalist, sprinter Usain Bolt, says Tyson Gay should have been banned for life. Former 100-meter and 200-meter world champion Gay was suspended for a year after testing positive for a banned anabolic steroid. The American's ban could have been 2 years, but was reduced for cooperation with the U.S. anti-doping agency. Bolt called the reduced ban, in his words, the stupidest thing I've ever heard. The Jamaican is quoted as saying that he is really upset with the decision to let Gay cut a deal. The 32-year-old Gay was back in action in June 2014, and over the last year has run faster times than Bolt, the 100-meter and 200-meter world record holder.
Visit VOA's website at www.voanews.com. You can read in-depth reports from VOA correspondents around the world. You can also download audio and video files and play them on your computer or portable MP3 player. www.voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Records and reputations are at stake at the 2015 Virgin Money London Marathon and IAAF Gold Labour Road Race on Sunday. The race celebrates its 35th edition this year with two of the greatest elite lineups ever seen. Paula Radcliffe makes her final appearance on the course where she pushed the bounds of female marathon running so spectacularly 12 years ago. She aims to run hard and enjoy the atmosphere one last time before receiving a Lifetime Achievement Award at the finish to mark her three London Marathon victories between 2002 and 2005. Like Radcliffe, Kenyan Dennis Kimeto is set to star in a men's race styled as a clash of the champions between himself and Wilson Kipsang, the former world record holder who broke the London course record last year when he won in 2 hours, 4 minutes and 29 seconds. Kimeto, who broke the 2-hour 3-minute barrier in September's Berlin Marathon, will make his London Marathon debut while Kipsang runs here for the fourth time after winning in 2012 and 2014. The two are training partners in E10 but have never faced each other over the marathon distance. Kipsang is aiming to become only the fourth man to take a hat-trick of London titles, and few would bet against him. The 33-year-old has won 8 marathons in his career, including his last 3 races. He broke the world record in Berlin in 2013 with 2 hours, 3 minutes and 23 seconds and was crowned 2013-2014 World Marathon Majors champion after winning the New York Marathon last November. The principal pair may dominate all the promotional material here, but they are merely the biggest names in a loaded field that includes not just the 4 quickest marathon runners of all time and 5 of the world's all-time top 10, but 8 men in total who have run sub 2 hours 5 minutes. Kipsang and Kimeto are joined by 5 other strong Kenyans, including 2011 London champion Emmanuel Mutai, who ran the second fastest time ever when finishing run-up to Kimeto in Berlin last year. Eliud Kipchoge, the former world 5,000 meters champion, who won the 2014 Rotterdam and Chicago marathons, and Geoffrey Mutai, the former Boston, New York, and Berlin marathon champion, who won the World Marathon Major Series in 2012. There is also Sami Kitwara, who was second in Chicago and third in Tokyo last year, and 2014 runner-up Stanley Biwott, another sub-2-hour, 5-minute man, who returns to the London Marathon seeking to go one better in 2015. Kenenisha Bekele and Ayele Abushore have both withdrawn with injuries, meaning the Ethiopian challenge rests with the 19-year-old 2014 Dubai champion Segaye Mekanen, who was fifth last year and boasts the fastest marathon time by a major. The women's race, meanwhile, features a quartet of Kenyans billed as the Fantastic Four at the top of a lineup that contains 9 runners who have completed the classic distance in under 2 hours 22 minutes. Last year, it was 2-time world champion Edna Kiplagat who sprinted to victory on the mall, beating her Kenyan compatriot and half-marathon world record holder Florence Kiplagat by just 3 seconds in the closest women's race for 17 years. The two are back this year to face the 2013 champion Priska Jipto, who dropped out with a calf problem 12 months ago, and Mary Keitan, who topped the London Marathon podium in 2011 and 2012, running sub 2 hours 20 minutes both times. And that's it for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Impuga. Sunny Young will be back next week. Now back to you, Yahias.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, the World Health Organization says the use of cesarean delivery is growing worldwide. And next, the biochemical bond that cements friendship between dogs and humans. But first, some music. Here is Stella Nanteza of Uganda with Majangwa.
Yesu,
mutwawe
ba. Ke mwononye
Kabarije
Amatiga mwepu sanze
Gata shwano nyo
Majangwa Yesu
utwawe
ba Kero mononye
Nabarije
Amatika mwepu sanze
Gata shwano nyo
Majangwa
Saoma ilo
Ukedote mia Kujukira mienku gamba Kujukira buwa jema Nova kukatonda o Sogo nija majangwa Olisanga wachitange What was it on da? Majangwa,
Salawal Walero.
If you come for me, Kugamba,
Yamu, where
you are? Yesu,
what were we?
Kero Mononye,
Lavalise.
Amatika Mwepu Sanze,
Kakashwano Nyo.
Majangwa,
Salawal Walero.
Chawe, Nancy Ojiwumule, Chiwe Wayo Majangwa, we no save a sitani, Dara Katakuyambe, Tosazo Kubi, Ojeka Wena Senda, Kumirani Mubanji, O Sanze Yojoita, Yero Nijene Wayes, O Yebu Sando Bujemu, we Chewa Kuyamba. Majangwa,
Salawa Leo.
Ebigambo byenku gamba,
Yamu wena nyo.
We kwate Yesu,
Kutwawe wa.
Kero mononye,
Nabarije.
Amatika mwenku sanze,
Kakashwano nyo.
Majangwa,
Salawa Leo.
Stella Nanteza of Uganda with Majangwa. The World Health Organization says the use of surgical childbirth or cesarean delivery is growing worldwide, particularly in high and middle-income countries. The WHO was concerned by the possible abuse of this important life-saving surgery. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization is a staunch supporter of cesarean sections when justified medically, because these operations can save lives. However, when a cesarean section is performed without medical need, it says mothers and their babies are put at risk of short and long-term health problems. Since 1985, health experts have considered the so-called ideal rate for C-sections to be between 10 and 15%. New studies show when the rates go below 10%, more mothers and babies die because they have no access to this life-saving intervention. This is borne out by statistics in Africa, which show a linkage between low C-section numbers and high mortality rates. On the other hand, studies indicate there is no evidence that mortality rates improve when the rate goes above 10%. Indeed, cesarean sections sometimes can have serious consequences. The director of WHO's Department of Reproductive Health and Research, Marlene Temmerman, tells VOA, a C-section is generally a safe operation, but risks to health do exist.
The chance of a complication is not that high, but the risk, the mortality can be very serious. You have like life-threatening complications due to bleedings, most of them. But also other complications like thromboembolic risks are higher after surgery than after a vaginal delivery.
However, Dr. Temmerman stresses a C-section is advisable when a vaginal delivery poses a risk to the mother or baby. For example, due to prolonged labor, fetal distress, or because the baby is in an abnormal position. She says she is concerned about the huge increase in the number of unnecessary cesarean sections being performed in both developed and developing countries. She says lifestyle issues generally are driving this epidemic of C-sections. As for the women, she says many prefer a C-section to a vaginal birth because they do not want the pain of delivery or may be afraid of the physical after effects. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Dogs serve in the military, work with police, and assist the disabled, and have been by our side for thousands of years, serving as companions and loyal friends. We love them. They love us in return. VOA's Roseanne Scherbel reports on a new study that looks at the biochemical bond that cements that human-canine connection.
The bond between a dog and its owner is a lot like that between a baby and its mother. The Japanese study reported in the journal Science finds that connection is driven in part by a hormone active in the brain and body of both humans and dogs. The hormone is oxytocin, says Evan McLean, co-director of Duke University's Canine Cognition Laboratory, who wrote a commentary that accompanies the study.
And in previous studies, both by this group of authors and by other authors, there has been some evidence that when we interact with dogs in friendly ways, humans tend to experience an increase in oxytocin, and we also see an increase in oxytocin in dogs as well.
Oxytocin can reduce stress, strengthen social relations, build trust, and in general make you feel good. It's naturally released from the brain when you shake hands, get a hug, or gaze into a loved one's eyes. The researchers ran two experiments to try to establish the hormone's role in the cross-species relationship. They first observed a group of dogs and their owners for 30 minutes, measuring oxytocin levels before and after the session. They recorded every social interaction, including talking, touching, and gazing. Dogs may feel challenged or intimidated by a direct stare, but McLean says eye contact is not a threat if it comes from their owner.
It's only in this group of dogs that looked at their owner for long periods of time that they detected an increase in oxytocin in the owners, and they also found a parallel increase in oxytocin in their dogs.
In a second experiment, dogs got either a dose of oxytocin or a placebo saline spray up their snouts before the session.
And what they found is that when they give dogs oxytocin, this actually caused the dogs to spend more time looking at their human owners. And as a consequence of that, The human owners themselves had an even bigger increase in oxytocin.
McLean says knowing the biology of this so-called feedback loop can help promote new health strategies for people with disabilities, children with autism, or soldiers diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder.
People report that they feel more secure. They report that they feel this bond with their animals, but we don't know much about the biology of how this happens. So this research, it certainly doesn't tell us that is the mechanism in those cases, but it suggests one possible pathway through which relationships with dogs may be therapeutic.
McLean says the biology of social relationships is complex, and while oxytocin is one piece of that puzzle, it is not the only element. He says future work must consider whether the study results observed among the adult dog owners could be generalized to apply to children, people with health problems, or even across cultures. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Lioness Remkes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Civil society is invaluable to building and maintaining a free, stable, and functional society capable of striving to fulfill its potential. Civil society is comprised of organizations and institutions which operate independently of the government. We refer to non-political, non-profit civil society organizations that act for the common good as non-governmental organizations, or NGOs. Civil society is the conscience of our countries. It's the catalyst of change. It's why strong nations don't fear active citizens, said President Barack Obama at the Civil Society Forum in Panama. Strong nations embrace and support and empower active citizens. Unfortunately, all over the world, the forum in which civil society operates is narrowing. Some voices are stifled. Others never even get the chance to be heard. Discrimination still locks too many out of our societies. Around the world, there are still too many places where laws are passed to stifle civil society, where governments cut off funding for groups that they don't agree with, said President Obama.
Whether it's crackdowns on free expression in Russia or China, or restrictions on freedom of association and assembly in Egypt, or prison camps run by the North Korean regime, human rights and fundamental freedoms are still at risk around the world. And when that happens, we believe we have a moral obligation to speak out.
Increasingly, civil society is a source of ideas about everything from promoting transparency and free expression to reversing inequality and rescuing our environment. And that's why, as part of our Stand with Civil Society initiative, we've joined with people around the world to push back on those who deny your right to be heard, said President Obama. When the United States sees space closing for civil society, we will work to open it. When efforts are made to wall you off from the world, we'll try to connect you with each other. When you are silenced, we'll try to speak out alongside you. And when you're suppressed, we want to help strengthen you. As you work for change, the United States will stand up alongside you every step of the way.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best pan-African music. Hello. This is
is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.